Bisal here of the Vault of Horror, and this is the Vault Cast. And tonight I'm joined by a very special guest. I have with me the director of the Commune, Elizabeth Fees. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi.
And for those of you who haven't heard yet or who may not be aware, the Commune is an independent horror/thriller that's sort of been making the rounds a lot of late. You might have seen it reviewed on some other blogs like Day of the Woman and Planet of Terror, and I had an opportunity very recently to watch the movie and myself, and so I wanted to bring Elizabeth on to talk about it, because I had a lot of questions and things that I wanted to know about the film, and I thought, hey, what better way than to get the filmmaker on the phone and talk. So thank you for coming on.
You bet. Thanks for watching it. Totally appreciate it.
Well, actually, you know, it's funny. The first thing I thought of when I was watching it was, you know, I think we talked about this very briefly before. What interested me the most about it was the fact that you really managed to pull off a real female point of view in this movie, which is so rare, especially for a horror movie. You know, even for horror movies or movies in general that have female leads, they still will have kind of a male point of view, you know, because it's usually made by a guy or whatever. But this, I really got the sense of a female point of view.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, that's probably the number one thing I wanted to accomplish in the film. Because it's just something that drives me nuts. I mean, I'm a screenwriter out here in Hollywood. I know the statistics. I know that only 8% of all Hollywood films that get made and released every year have a female protagonist. And, you know, even of those, the majority are going to be written, directed, produced by men. So it's just one of those things where I find it really curious that, you know, with 51% of the buying population being female, that people still haven't figured out yet that there's actually an audience for a true female voice. But it's definitely something that people in Hollywood don't think should exist or can exist in a financial sense. And I know that there are a lot of people out there like you who appreciate it when they get to see it. So, yeah, I mean, as an indie filmmaker, I really wanted to do something outside of the box because I wasn't trapped inside of Hollywood and you know, get a chance to do something I may never get to do again. So I was really excited, and I really tried to work with my female producer and my lead the whole time about being authentic, and I'd run things by them and make sure that I got camera angles that were how a woman sees the world,
Well, you know,
I appreciate that.
Well, you mentioned actually something that caught my attention, you know, how it's almost as if Hollywood as an entity, however you want to put it, doesn't want something like that. Now, why do you think that is? I mean, you said yourself it's 51% of the buying public, so why is there such a stubbornness to, you know, to portray that?
You know, I graduated in 95 from UCLA. I've been working my whole life in the industry, either as an actor or training or, you know, everything. You know, it's been a long 30 years for me at this point. And I can't honestly figure it out, because people will even say, no, Hollywood will do anything, they'll make money. But, you know, is obviously there's a miscommunication here. There's something going on. I don't know. I mean, it's not like there's some with kind of that Lane Bryant commercial of the gorgeous woman plus size model in the bra on, you know, television 2 weeks ago because it's too sexy or it's not sexy enough or whatever it is. But there is something going on where there's a weird censorship of women and of certain women's voices that doesn't correspond in any way to the idea that Hollywood will do whatever is economically best for them. I don't know who it is or what it is or where the power structure is, and I've certainly talked to enough friends in the industry and done my own studying, and, you know, of course, I'm an acolyte of the WomenOfHollywood.com site, and we can't figure out the power structure, really, of who it is. I mean, even in the studio where you have a female running it, they accomplish very little in changing any of this. So I don't honestly know. And I know that there's a market for it because women want to see themselves. Everybody wants to see themselves. Kids would like to see accurate representations of themselves. Every ethnic group would love to see themselves. I mean, it doesn't feel good to watch other people and have to substitute, you know, constantly your life experiences for other people. So, I mean, the short answer is no. But just from the point of view of somebody who's also dedicated my life to, you know, making partnerships between the genders, between having men and women work together to make the world a better place, it's really frustrating for me because, you know, the biggest myth in our culture is that men can't know women, that women are ununderstandable. And, you know, a big way to understand women would be to let them freaking tell their stories and listen to them. So I find that really frustrating.
Well, that's a good point. You would think it would be common sense.
Right.
But before we go any further, actually, I wanted to jump back just a little bit because I realized we jumped right into it. But for those who might not be aware, the commune, was it actually produced last year or was it 2008?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that. Did you say was it produced by a woman or was it produced in 2008?
No, I asked if it was produced last year or 2008.
Oh, gotcha. Well, you know, I mean, it's kind of hard. The official release date, 2009, we shot it, I think, in September, 2007.
Okay.
And then took like a year and a half to test and edit it. Because it actually ended up being a lot more challenging than I thought it would be to create a thriller puzzle as an indie movie. Mm-hmm. Because unfortunately, you know, any scene that doesn't work, which happens quite often in indie films for a variety of reasons, and they're all budgetary and you know, speed related. Any of those that came out made the story, you know, a mess because it was a part of the puzzle piece.
Right.
So we actually spent a lot of time in the editing room afterwards trying to, like, kind of restructure the story so that people could figure out what the hell was going on.
Okay, well, to put people up to speed, you know, without giving anything away, it's sort of a kind of a throwback to 70s horror, you know, and it's the story of Jenny Cross, who is played very well, by the way, by Chantal Lewis, who is a young girl who is kind of handed over by her mother into the custody of her father, who is almost like this Jim Jones figure, you know, kind of like a hippie cult leader. And she kind of just gets pulled into this very bizarre world, which as the film goes along, we learn more and more about just exactly how bizarre it is. And I'm not going to give away too much, but that's the gist of it. And it played, it really was making the rounds, correct, at a lot of film festivals last year, Cine Fantasy and Buried Alive and places like that. And well reviewed in the Huffington Post, Horror Society. And, you know, it's kind of been getting a bit of buzz, to say the least. My question is, was it difficult making this movie? You know, was it difficult getting it off the ground? It's definitely unorthodox. You know, was it hard to get the funding to make it and actually make it happen?
Well, funding-wise, we raised about half the money and I put in the rest. I was supposed to get paid back at some point, but we went over budget and I just kept chipping in. But we did raise the money. I have a great producing partner named Heidi Hornbacher, who's really good at raising money. And we took a bunch of classes and learned how to do it correctly. But it came together pretty fast. We actually initially were going to shoot my, I have an acclaimed script called Pistoleras. Mm-hmm. That is a spaghetti western that is an empowering kind of antithesis to the Charlie's Angels idea. It's like much more street fighting and real girls, like more like girls from the craft.
So it's a spaghetti western with a female lead then.
Yeah, four female leads.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, the Teen Chick Spaghetti Western, and it's won two big contests. It won Final Draft, or not Final Draft, Sorry, I just entered that one. Ooh, maybe we will win Final Draft. We won Creative Screenwriting Magazine's Best Action, and what's the other one? I can't think of the other one right now because it was like 3 years ago.
Well,
but anyway, we were gonna go make that. We had it all cast. We got half of our locations down. We went and did a test shoot, and we realized it was just too big of a movie to make as a low budget. It just was gonna be really bad.
So was that then?
There were like 50 locations and probably 50 characters, and it was not designed to be a low budget film.
So is that what led you into the commune to make a different kind of movie?
Yeah, because, I love horror movies, and thrillers are my absolute favorite, but I had two-thirds of the commune written, and when we scrapped everything that year in March, I think it was March, it's either March 2007 or March 2008, maybe it's 2008, when we scrapped that, I started looking at the commune again, and I finished it. I finished it in the end of July, right before I went to Comic-Con. And the next week we were location scouting, and a few weeks later we were shooting it.
So, you know, then is horror something that you could see yourself continuing with and sticking with that genre? Or do you think you kind of want to, you know, jump around?
I love horror. I have a lot more horror stories I want to tell. I am a genre jumper always, though, in the way that John Carpenter is. I mean, I don't really see myself doing a drama, but... you know, I love sci-fi, I love action, I love, you know, I would definitely want to keep doing mixes of all the genres that are frankly looked down upon in the industry.
Yeah.
Feature.
Well, I for one, I mean, this is your first feature, is it?
It's my first writing directing feature.
Right,
I was an associate producer on an indie film that won a Spirit Award in 2006.
Well, I mean, I hope, I really do hope that this isn't, you know, I hope that you can continue making features, because, I mean, you know, if this is your first full-fledged one, I'd love to be able to see where, you know, you develop as a creator and as an artist from here, honestly, because, you know, I think it's a great start. So I think there's a lot of people that would like to see where it goes from there, and so hopefully that'll happen. But I wanted to talk about a little bit more of the movie itself. We started off talking about the female perspective of it. I wanted to just bring up something that immediately struck me when I was watching it, and it's really going to sound like I'm reducing this to the most kind of puerile, you know, reduction. So you'll have to forgive me. But one of the things where it hit me in the face, how I was watching a totally different type of movie, was the scene where she first meets Puck, and she's kind of checking him out, and he's walking away from her, and there's a close-up shot of his ass as he's walking away, and her reaction. And I remember thinking to myself, you know what? I don't think I've ever seen that done before. I've seen it done a million times the other way around. I don't think I've ever seen that done in a movie before. A little thing like that, you know?
So much. I so love that you appreciated that. You saw it, and you get why it's important. And that's part of what I'm talking about, like, you know, there just need to be more voices of every race and women, you know, being able to show their point of view is that's kind of ridiculous. That, you know, that it's 2010.
Yes, it is.
God's sake. And you think that might be the first time, and it might be. I'm not really sure. It was a shot that I fought for, that I really wanted in the movie and was really important to me. And it's funny because we were shooting 7 pages a day and it was so run and gun style, I really had to pick one shot every 2 or 3 pages where I was like, okay, this is the shot I want. And everything else, you know, was basically done in our master style of the, you know, flowy back and forth thing.
Right.
And that was one of the ones that was written in the script and that I discussed with my DP. And the day we shot it, we were running late and he wouldn't give me the shot. And I figured out that I thought it was actually a psychological thing with him. And I pushed and I pushed and it wasn't going to happen. And we actually did a reshoot and went and got that shot for me later. And God bless David Lago. He was like, of course you can have it. I understand why it's important to you. And he came back and we shot that outside of my sister's condo back here in L.A. and inserted it in.
How about that?
But I was not going to have the movie without that. That's my second favorite shot, I think, next to the one that ends the first act, which is also one I fought for, I think, that same day. Because we were out on the highway filming it, which is the one where Jenny is deciding, it's the first act break, so she's deciding if she's going to leave with Puck and run away from the commune, or if she's going to stay on the commune so that she can spend the summer romancing Puck.
Right.
And she looks from her dad to Puck, who gives her what I wrote in the script is the Tom Cruise Top Gun grin, and then looks back at her dad. And,
yes, I remember the part you're talking
okay.
about.
Yeah, it says, okay, I'm going to stay. And I was really, really proud of that because, A, it's that female perspective. B, you know, no woman on the planet would believe that she would leave after Puck looked at her like that. Every woman would stay for love. And C, I'm not actually that visual of a writer. I tend to be very Gilmore Girls, and as you can tell, I'm really talkative. And so one thing I often struggle with in my scripts and why I have to, you know, like on Pistoleros, do 20 drafts, is because I have to keep going back and taking language out of it. You know, I'm much too Tarantino. And so to actually have an act break end on a visual for me was such a win. I was just like, yes, you know, I've progressed as a filmmaker. So, yeah, that was very exciting for me.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the influences here, because obviously the Wicker Man, the original, because as far as I'm concerned, that's the only one. The Wicker Man looms large over this film for sure. And you know, you mentioned Heidi at Pretty Scary, and it's funny because I think they were the ones who said, or I don't know if it was her specifically, but that this is the movie that the Wicker Man remake would have been if it had any balls. I think that was the quote, right?
That was the quote. I started crying when I read that. I was so happy. Oh, my God. That was amazing.
Well, yes. I don't think it's going out on a limb here to say, and this is not even, you know, this is a superior film to the Wicker Man remake. I mean, I think I've seen, you know, I've seen test patterns that were superior to the Wicker Man remake, at least. But,
Well, so then it's not really a compliment.
No, it's no, not necessarily, but... but the influence is huge in the movie, obviously, of The Wicker Man. I'm sure that was something that you had consciously in mind.
Can I just say for a second, side note, horror geek to horror geek, how fucking upset I was as The Wicker Man being my favorite film when I read that Neil LaBute was going to write and direct it. Because the remake, I mean, yeah. I knew this. Who didn't know this 4 years ago when they announced that? Because, I mean...
Well, how about when they announced that Nicolas Cage would be taking over the Edward Woodward role? I think that was the nail in the coffin for me. I that was it. The end.
Yeah. I mean, Nick, I think he can be directed, but I guess my point is just, you know, I'm a very pro-woman-centric person, and The Wicker Man is about a goddess society, and you put somebody who is... you know, next to Lars von Trier, is considered the biggest misogynist filmmaker in the world.
Yeah.
In what's supposed to be a female-centric film. And you get what we got, which was women getting hit and, you know, the stupid bear costume. And, like, it was such a fucking joke. And I was so disappointed because it could have been amazing. They could have really used the opportunity to talk about gender and to do something interesting. And God knows the original is just so brilliant. And we're only seeing half the film, for God's sake.
I think.
And you know, it was like being like, yeah, you know, I mean, this is a huge exaggeration. And obviously I'm tired because it's late at night. But it's like going, oh, yeah, you know, Hitler's going to direct Schindler's List. How do you think that's going to turn out? You know, like, no, it's not going to be good.
Yeah, that's...
an idiot out of that.
Yeah, that would be a bad idea, definitely. But,
I mean, the thing is, I was Wiccan in high school. I know all about these goddess religions. I grew up all around it. I was very interested in it from the point of view of empowering women and from reclaiming what, you know, a lot of Christianity has taken away from them. just something as simple as May Day that we just had.
Right.
And how, you know, that was converted over in Catholicism to the, you know, Queen of the May Day, but it's Mary the Virgin instead mm-hmm. of the goddess, where everybody goes, you know, has sex at Beltane and goes around the maypole. You know, I was very interested in that. I was very interested in the Wicker Man and how they pitted the old pagan against the new Christian, and how it was so brilliant that, I mean, the number one plot device you can use going back to the time of the Greeks is hubris. And the way they had Ed Woodward just so convinced that because he was right, and because yes. he had the law on his side, and because he had Christ on his side, that no harm would come to him. And then, you know, he meets this horrible, horrible fate
yes.
that he deserves on the behalf of all the things he represents as a bad hierarchy.
That was the downfall.
These people.
I think that was at the heart of the downfall of the remake, is that they completely had no patience for what the police inspector character was supposed to be all about. Which is that he is supposed to be a devout, I'm not sure if he's Catholic, but he might be, but a devout Christian who is morally abhorred or you know, just revolted by this pagan society that he finds himself in. And that's at the heart of the whole thing. And with Nicolas Cage and the character that they turned him into, it's irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant because religion is not even a factor. It's utterly irrelevant. And I think that's what wound up undoing the movie, other than the complete ridiculousness of it. But I mean, that's the central flaw of the movie, is that that whole element is gone, and that's the main point of the movie.
Well, the only agenda on Neil LaBute's plan for the remake was that women are ball breakers. It was all about a gender war, sort of a religion war, and it was much less interesting because he didn't make either argument.
Yeah,
and it's like they didn't know what they were doing. I mean, what they plugged in was the standard cop with a haunted past,
right,
who needs to redeem himself, which, you know, we're all fucking sick of anyway. And then they did it poorly. And then it doesn't belong in The Wicker Man anyway. It's in the same way that nothing that Zombie did belongs in the Halloween remake. It's just the wrong venue for it.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
And it's done poorly. So, you know, so then you end up with us laughing at it and, oh, the bees. But it's very frustrating seeing how intellectually brilliant the first one was.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so frustrating that would become what we have now.
Well, yeah,
it's almost as frustrating to me as that, you know, so many people don't know that they're watching the 88-minute version and that they're not seeing the movie.
Right, which is lost. The footage is literally lost. It was destroyed. We'll never have it.
I've seen the 97-minute version. It's fantastic. There's an orgy scene.
There's more than that, though. There's more footage than that was originally.
Oh, no, I know.
And it's all gone. It's all gone.
And that's all that we have anything is all due to Christopher Lee. I mean, Sir Christopher Lee's holy thought for that film for 30 years, and he's amazing. Amazing, amazing, amazing. And I can't wait to see what they do with their Redux version, because they're also remaking it in an alternate universe with different characters the way I did. So I'm really, really curious to see what happens with them. It used to be called Cowboys for Christ, and they just renamed it, which is a shame. I don't remember what it's called now. Something kind of dry.
Well, I know that actually, in addition to The Wicker Man, I happen to know that you do have a particular affinity for Aliens and Terminator 2, those being huge influences on you, right, as a fan and as a filmmaker. I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about that and why those movies in particular are so important. Because I have to say something, and this is not to undo you before you even start, but I'm one of those people that I used to really think that the second Terminator and Aliens were the superior ones, and a lot of people came to that conclusion after seeing them. But over the years, I tended to kind of go back to the original ones. Like, I like the original Terminator better, even though it's far more low-key. And the same for the original Alien. It's far more low-key. But for some reason, I tend to kind of... I think those movies held up a little better than the sequels. I'm sure you disagree, but...
Oh, no. It's not about... I mean, this is like children. It's not about, like, either or. I'm a genre lover, so I'm going to be a geek about what's the genre. I really like to distinguish that, because I think in the same way that Roger Ebert's always very brilliant about saying this was a perfect horror film. you know, that you have to, like, know that as a storyteller when you're watching something. So you can't compare Alien and Aliens because they're not the same genre.
Mm-hmm.
Second one is a war movie. It's a very successfully done war movie. I don't like war movies. I fucking love Aliens. Alien is a horror film. And frankly, Terminator is a horror film.
Yes.
It's not an action film. Every genre, it's not even like a genre mix. Everything that they do in that film is a horror film standard. The second movie is an action film, but it's an action film with a female lead, and we hadn't really seen that. We've seen Ripley in a war movie, but we hadn't really seen a female action lead. And I strongly feel, I think that you probably picked this up because I think I've been talking about The Descent too a lot this week online.
Yes.
And why I love these films is because James Cameron in both of them and Ridley Scott in the first Alien managed to tell a female story with a very, I think, a very female point of view. Except for one scene of Ridley in the first film, she's not actually sexualized. Except of course for the horrible scene of her in the underwear, which is incredibly sexualized. She's even sounding like she's orgasming when she's breathing heavy. But like, other than that, for the most part, you know, it doesn't. And originally the role was written for a man.
Yes.
You know, Ripley, and they didn't. You know, they didn't change that. They didn't change anything about it. So you get a more pure female point of view for the first time within those genres. And James Cameron is someone who can obviously handle strong women in his life. He loves having strong women in his life. And I trust him more than most people to be able to really try to communicate a woman's point of view. And I adore him for it. I think it's fantastic. So I was really excited, you know, as a young teen and as a filmmaker to see these films because it was the first time I was seeing something on screen that I could identify with. You know, women don't watch Charlie's Angels and feel empowered. That's not made for women.
Right.
You don't look at that and go, oh, maybe someday I could fly and you know, my boots could jiggle. It's not empowering to us. But, you know, to watch Ripley or to watch Sarah Connor is incredible. And, you know, it's something that, like, I even, you know, I'm heterosexual, but I can get on the treadmill and be like, I'm going to look like her, you know, and,
right.
and start going to town and, like, imagining, you know, like, I want to be on her team or I want to be her. That's something I can emulate. Why am I talking about this? Oh, I know, because it's so rare, because, like, Tomb Raider is a film, again, that's made for men.
Yes, completely.
It's not made with any interest in a female audience. She's too sexualized. She's doing things and bending over and picking things up or whatever to show her ass. It's not about her journey. And women know that right away. I mean, we're trained, we're much more effectively trained than men are to pick up on that because the majority of our lives have been spent, you know, through voyeuristically watching male protagonists. So we pick up those nuances really quick. We know if the movie is made for us or not. And, you know, something like The Descent and The Descent 2, which again has been ignored a lot by the horror community, these are amazing, empowering films that I think that men who really love women and want to know women can watch and, like, you know, maybe even ask the woman, like, what does that provide for you? Why is this exciting to you? And, like, have a conversation about it because it's such a fruitful area. I mean, like, I don't know if you saw The Descent 2 yet, but I was excited because they added men in it, and I thought it was wonderful. I thought it was so smart the way they did it, and I thought it was still really true to all the characters and that both genders were really empowered and worked well together as a team. And I don't know, I'm really, really hyped right now about The Descent 2, and they're huge fans, obviously, of Aliens and Terminator 2 because they're constantly riffing on it. And just as a filmmaker, I can see that. There's nods to it everywhere. And really exciting to see, like, another new generation of filmmakers that, like, understood why those were cool and why they were interesting and like, decided to do another one.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things that come to mind when you were talking about that. And in the original, going back to the original Alien, I think one of the things that that accentuates it even more, I always thought it was unusual. It was kind of, I mean, clearly it's intentional, that while you have Ripley, and played by Sigourney Weaver, which is a character that could have been a man or a woman, and it wouldn't have even mattered. It was interchangeable. But at the same time, you have Nancy Cartwright, who is the absolute stereotype of the hysterical woman. Like just falling apart, completely unable to hold it together. She's the classic kind of trope of the helpless female, in contrast to what Ripley is.
Yeah, but I would definitely, I mean, yes, and that's awesome. I don't know that the filmmakers went into that trying to show like two different sides of women, though. I mean, this is something that I've spent a full day examining before in Robert McKee's class, and it's very much more like the eight characters or however many there were the representation of all human emotions, you know, the way that every slasher film is.
Right.
And there's a whole order to it. You get ticked off then in order by what your weakness is. And the only person who survives at the end, who is often the final girl, but not always, sometimes it's the final man, is the person who embodies all of those characteristics as a holistic, good, balanced whole. In the same way that your greatest weakness is your greatest strength and your greatest strength is your greatest weakness, that's how in a slasher film each person will get picked off. So that's really what they were showing there was actually, one of the characters was, whether he was black or white or male or female, one's a coward, one's too impulsive, one's too naive, that type of thing.
Yeah.
She was too emotional. And it happened to be a woman. But, to me, I love Alien. It's brilliant. It's fucking brilliant. But to me, it's just, again, a slasher film. And as a storyteller, I get really sick. I mean, every slasher film is just another retelling of 10 Little Indians.
It is a slasher film?
As a storyteller, I get really tired of that. I'm like, about all you can do to really make it interesting as a storyteller is, like, do a Deadpool and be like, I wonder which order they're going to kill people off in.
But I think what's great about Alien, though, is yes, it is a slasher film that's all dressed up, but it's so far. Like, slashers are not my favorite subgenre, typically.
Right.
But for
right.
some reason, it's with Ridley Scott doing it and everything, it's so much better made. There's so much more skill. You just see it all on the screen. You could see that it's just a masterful piece of work, as opposed to, some of the schlocky kind of 80s slashers, which just follow this routine and this kind of ritual. And they're just, honestly, they're just poorly made. I think that's what saves Alien, is that it's a very well-made movie.
No, I completely agree. And that's what I meant by, it's in my top 20 favorites. It's just not in my top 10. I mean, like, for me, that's what I meant by the Roger Ebert thing about you have to know which genre you're talking about. Because then it's like, okay, to put Alien up against Halloween and decide which one's the best film. You got to compare apples to apples.
Right, or you wouldn't compare it to My Fair Lady.
Say again?
I said, you wouldn't compare it to My Fair Lady or something like that. It wouldn't
really make sense. Exactly. So in a way, it's kind of weird to compare Alien to Aliens because it's not, you can't. Like, it's the same characters, but it's a totally different genre and a totally different universe. And you know what it is? It's Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. Ebert made this really great argument about Silence of the Lambs, and I think he's done it about Alien as well because, Alien, the first one's horror, the second one is war. The third one is actually Frankenstein. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The third one's down the penal colony. The third one's a straight-up police
procedural.
Jail.
Yeah.
The fourth one is Frankenstein. So, these are not the same. You're not having straight sequels, which is part of why they were good and interesting. And, the same thing happened with Silence of the Lambs, because the first one is a very classic, thriller, criminal, psychologist film. Serial killer film, and the second one is straight up Grand Guignol.
Yes.
So you can't say, Hannibal sucks, because you can't compare it to Silence of the Lambs, because, who else has made a Grand Guignol film, at that time in the last 20 years? You gotta compare it to what it is, and it's pretty brilliant that way. it was really wonderful gothic romance horror.
It was definitely a complete shift.
Oh, go ahead. Being too geeky, I can talk forever. I'm so sorry.
No, I love talking about this stuff. I feel bad. Like, we should probably talk a little bit more about your film.
This is so much more fun.
Yeah.
Here's the point I can wrap up, is why I liked Terminator 2 so much, and why I list it as, like, you know, in a tie for my number one film, is because as a filmmaker, when I saw T2, I think I was 18 when I saw it, and what I realized when I saw it was, well, first of all, the script is just brilliant, but I won't get into that, but I realized that you could have an amazing point of view with a female character, really, like, showing women and being powerful, and you could have a globally successful film, action film, that people would watch, and at the base of it really have a message, you know, because people never really picked up on it as much in Terminator 2 as they obviously have in Avatar, but, you know, James Cameron is totally shoving a message down with his spoonful of sugar, which is, we're going to make this big, awesome action hit, but it's really about peace on Earth. And, you know, and I really got, as a filmmaker, what he was doing, and I got really excited because I wanted to do that too, and that was actually how and why I wrote Pistoleros. So I used his formula of doing the same kind of thing, of like having a really clear message that I wanted to get across, but making it as entertaining as possible within it. And the other film that's my favorite film that is tied with is Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which I saw when I was 16, and that was when I first, you know, I'd always loved films and I'd always studied and done all this preparation to come down to Hollywood, but that was the first time, because it was so small and it was the beginning in 1989 of the indie film movement, where I went, I could do that. I could direct. And I was 16 and I was in the theater and I was a girl and there weren't any other girl directors I knew of. And I was like, I can make that movie. I could do that. And I got really excited and I loved that it was so personal and that it was so explorative and so embarrassing and sexual and erotic and, like, all these wonderful things. So for me as a filmmaker, you know, my path has been that my first movie, The Commune, to me is like Sex, Lies, and Videotape. You know, low budget and very, very kind of confessional and personal.
Well, let me ask you,
hopefully Pistoleros will be my second and be my T2.
You can have all kinds of explosions and morphing special effects in the next one, then.
Well, it's not that kind of action. I'm a martial artist, so I actually really, really enjoy seeing a good street fight. I like down and dirty fighting. I don't like the wire work. It's pretty, but it's, to me, it's like going to the ballet. I'm much more excited and engaged if you're feeling every blow that the protagonist is feeling, and every punch matters. So it's much more. This is going to be down and dirty 16-year-old girls fighting for their lives. So, yeah. No, scratching or hair pulling. This is limbs getting torn and, you know,
well,
noses getting stuffed into their brains.
Nice. Oh, that's very nice. Like a fire starter. It's great. How's that for a geek reference? See, there you go. But you talked a little bit about, you know, stuff that you think really worked with this film, The Commune, that you're happy with. Now, this being your first, obviously there's always going to be things you felt like you could do better, or you look back at it and you second guess yourself and things like that. I mean, what were some of the things that you can comfortably say that you are less than happy with how the film turned out, if you don't mind talking about that?
Well, this one's always tough because it's, you know, I mean, obviously I'm actually talking to a journalist and to people who hopefully will like the movie. So I try to be really candid. I'm known for that. But there is a level that I can never truly be, that it's been a privilege to become a director, because I can now go all the time at lunches with other directors. And we have these candid discussions all the time with each other. And we actually are totally truthful.
Right.
So, unfortunately, I have to sort of flip my little switch on and be like, Liz, don't say that. But
well, no, of course not. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be sitting here saying, yes, no one should see this movie because it has this, and this wrong with it.
Nobody is 100% happy with their film. It doesn't happen. Unless some asshole like Kubrick, who gets to do 150 takes, he better have been happy with The Shining, is all I can say.
Well, it's perfect from beginning to end, and it is because he shot every scene 800 times. And, you know,
I mean, I want to cry I just want to weep when I read about, like, him and Woody Allen and all the money they wasted.
Yes.
Because as somebody who had no money and literally was shooting 7 minutes a day, you know, and these people are shooting, taking 3 weeks to shoot one shot, I just, you know, it killed me. It killed me. I'm like, well, you better have made a perfect movie, Apple. You better fucking love it.
Well, I think about,
like, you know, there were times when my monitor was down and I never got to see the shot at all, and we only had two takes, and, you know, like, come on.
Oh, yeah. I know. I always think about the scene in the kitchen in The Shining with Scatman Crothers. That's supposedly the scene where it set the record for the most takes. I think it was, yeah, something like 150. And I always feel so bad for when I hear about that. I feel bad for Scatman Crothers, because the poor guy, I mean, really, honestly, he wasn't even really an actor, you know? He was sort of like a song and dance man. And here he is stuck. Yeah. He's stuck with this neurotic director shooting a scene with a little boy 150 times, talking about ice cream and Shining, and he must have been losing his mind.
I don't have any patience for it. I mean, there have been times, I mean, I've been an actor for 30 years, and there have been times where I've been on a set where I think the highest I've ever been at was like 22, where I've been involved in a scene where they did it 22 times. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Because either you know what you want or you don't. And if you don't have it by now, you're not going to get it. So move on. Yes. I mean, you know, I don't get it.
Well, that was the Sinatra approach, when he was notorious for that. Is he would give, you know, he was totally method in his approach to acting. He would throw everything into it, totally give himself to it, and do the scene. And if you got it, you got it. And if you weren't happy with it, it was too bad. You know, he gave you everything he had, and that was that.
Yeah, you know, that's funny. Now that you say that, I remember hearing that. And you just put a puzzle piece together for me, because I had read recently that one of the shots that critics have always said is, like, the most brilliant, and they read all this wonderful stuff into it, happened during the Manchurian Candidate. There's at some point during it where there's a shot that, like, is out of focus, and then it racks into focus on him.
Yes.
And the you know, the critics are like, what a brilliant choice the director made right then, and blah blah blah, and it really shows how he was under mind control. And it turns out that's literally the only shot they had.
Yes.
And you know, as somebody who used a couple out of focus shots, you go with it. And the director's like, what I read was the director was like, Jesus Christ, like, you know, it was the only shot we had.
Well, because it was this crazy monologue that Sinatra's character in that movie had given, and apparently, you know, he was so prepared for this scene, and he put everything in it. He was so intense, and he was so proud of it. And then when they found that it was soft, the director, who was, the name escapes me, but it's a very well-known guy, but he was very young and just kind of starting out at the time. He was terrified, absolutely terrified, because he went to Sinatra and said, look, I think we need to redo this. And it was just, you know, just flat out refused to do it. And he said, look, I'm not doing that again. Like, that was, I poured my guts out, and I'm not doing it again. And that's that. You know, I mean, I guess that's kind of prima donna-ish, but the result was that scene stayed the way it was, and it's actually perfect the way it is.
Amazing. I'm a big, big fan of those happy accidents, and that's the kind of magic you look for on set. But sometimes the things that you're the most worried about that you didn't get, you know, you have to come up with a solution that's better in the editing room, where you have to, you know, change something in the story around, and you find out it makes magic. And I mean, that's one of my absolute favorite things about filmmaking, is I can't think of another craft where things happen like that, where there's, you know, an entire army or team of people coming together. And if something goes wrong and isn't the way your vision thought it should be, sometimes it's really the universe helping you out unconsciously to, like, find the better way to tell your story. And it's such a privilege to be a part of. It's really cool.
Well, how did you feel about appearing in your own film?
Oh, I wouldn't do it again. I actually have a really funny story about this. I can't remember. I think I still haven't told anybody about it. And I've definitely never told anybody about it. You're my only audio interview, so this should be interesting to tell you. So I've been a professional actor for 30 years. I'm actually good, despite what you've seen in the film. And what happened is, my mentor, Kat Shea, who's a wonderful writer-director. She did Poison Ivy. She was the shit in Hollywood in 91 for doing Poison Ivy. Wow. And has done a bunch of other great stuff. She's a mentor of mine, and I often will go and do her acting class because she likes to teach me, fellow female director, like how to spot quickly when an actor is going into their head and it is, you know, not in the scene, and how to like whack them out of it really fast because you don't have a lot of time on set. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to change even if it goes down to like 4 or 5 minutes a day of shoot. You know, I'm going to still have to really like, you know, have great methods that I can use quickly on set to get them back into the pure space where they're listening. So I often go to her class, and she got really impressed with me and was like, God, you know, you're a really good actor. I don't understand why you don't have an agent. Why aren't you doing this? And I just told her, like, feminist to feminist, woman to woman. I was like, I cannot play the Hollywood game. It's just not in me. So as an actor, what I do, you know, is I occasionally just act for my friends. You know, my friends know I'm good or what role that I should be put in, and sometimes they'll call me up and say, actually, you're going to be here. I'm not playing Hollywood bullshit casting stuff. I don't want to be a part of it. Just can't. So, you know, the movie was coming up, and I had a really great night in her class, and she was like, God, you're so good. I don't, you know, why don't you put yourself in your movie? I'm like, oh, I don't know. I've already got all this other stuff going on. I'm doing 9 jobs on the film because we can't pay other people. I'm like, I don't know. She's like, you really should. You really think about it. You really should. So I decide, okay, I'm going to play the mom. And I'm like, Kat, you know, I'm like, Kat's my Yoda. She says I should do it. I'm going to do it. So I go off. I do the movie. Sure as shit, you know, we're shooting 7 pages a day. I have no time to ever memorize. I can't, you know, work with the actors. I can never rehearse. But, you know, I've got, you know, at that point, like 27 years of training. I'm like, I can handle it. I'm doing all this other stuff. I'll just take off that director-producer hat when the time comes, and I'll act. And what happened is, you know, during all my scenes, I took off all the other hats except for the producer hat. I don't know what it is, and I've talked to a few other people at this point about it, but I could never let go of it's 20 minutes to lunch, or my grip coughed. My God, my grip coughed. Is he getting sick? We're fucked if Big Matt gets sick. What am I going to do? Like, during the scene, I could never get into that space of just being an actor. I was always judging it from the producing point of view, which I had no tools to, like, combat that, and I had no time. And so I didn't do a good job. And one of the first things that I would do is take myself out of the film. I would never, in an indie film situation where you're shooting 7 minutes a day, I would never do that again. But the joke is, from my Yoda, is when I come home and I show Kat the film, and Kat was wonderful during the cutting process. She probably watched it like 10 different times. And she was very, very, she was like the best person ever about giving feedback because she would not know how to fix it. She, you know, very Yoda. Well, I see an issue here. Go work on it kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I show her the movie the first time, and she turns to me at the end of it. And the first thing she says to me is, and that's why you should never cast yourself in your own movie.
Well, you know, in all fairness, let me just say, I can't be in her shoes, see it from her point of view, but I think maybe, you know, in a way, it's almost sort of like a compliment, because I think part of it might be, from what she saw, is the fact that Chantel Lewis is so great. You know what I mean? And she nailed it so well.
No, it wasn't that. I totally appreciate that. But Chantel and I have done wonderful things together. It's not a comparison of Chantel to me. It's truly, this was her Yoda way. What she said is that I would never accept it unless I tried it. Mm-hmm. That every director who started as an actor has to try it, because they have to learn for themselves that they fall flat on their face. But, you know, unless you're Kevin Costner and you're shooting a minute or 2 minutes a day.
Right. Well, Mel Gibson, I mean, right?
Mel Gibson, that's not even, I mean, that is such a different world than what we're talking about with what the majority of people have to do with their budget. You know, know, I mean, if you have all fucking day to go back and check playbacks, and all you have to do is get 2 minutes in the can that day, God bless you. You better be able to act. But, you know, when you've got 9 different hats on, and, you know, the check just bounced to the caterer, and you don't know if you're going to be able to feed the crew in half an hour when you're done, like, it's such a different world.
So there's something, actually.
The thing is, you know, most actors, when they come onto set, all they're doing is acting. That's their only job all day long. So you don't want to be the asshole that has 8 other jobs, because it doesn't work well.
So actually, that was something that you were less than happy with about the movie, was your own performance in it. How about that?
Yeah, it's not the first thing that I would change, but it's definitely one of them. My biggest problem with the film is that we had some scenes in the second act that we had to cut because they didn't turn out, and they were some scares that would have kept the thriller moving along.
Mm-hmm.
And we've definitely had, I think you mentioned it, and somebody else in the last week or two has mentioned it, and pacing-wise, it's disappointing to me that those scenes aren't there, and that we didn't have the money to go back and shoot anything that would fit better to really keep it in a thriller convention and moving along better. And, of course, we got a little bit of better, and then Chantel was in a horrific car accident and lost her left hand. So we couldn't have shot, you know, now we could never shoot anything anyway because it just wouldn't match. So, you know, that's disappointing as a filmmaker. I mean, it's really, really hard to make a thriller as an indie because, like I was talking about with the shifting puzzle pieces, nothing ever works as well on the page as it does. I mean, you just don't know. Even seasoned people don't really know. Like, you can read a page and think it's brilliant, and then you shoot it, and it just totally falls flat. You know, right. There are definitely, I think you were talking about that in Brittany's thread about The Shining, about, you know, the difference between literature and film. And sometimes you just don't know until you get in the editing room. And, you know, that can present storytelling problems in romantic comedies and in horror and action. But in thrillers, it kills your entire story. Because if that happens to be one of the scenes that had the big clue in it, you know, for that 10-minute segment, you're fucked. Because you have to have that clue. You're only supposed to tell a clue once. And if that was your scene and it was out of focus, or one of the actresses didn't know her lines, or, you know, you only got one shot at it and you know, there's starburst all over it, or, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of things that can go wrong, or it just doesn't work. Or people say it's boring, you know, and then you're in the editing room and you're like trying to figure out, oh my God, like, okay, we don't have any money to go reshoot anything. Like, how can we convey that piece of information that people need so that this is a thriller that people are solving? And, you know, it was a pretty big challenge that I just hadn't anticipated. I think both my editor and I were pretty floored by it, by how much, I mean, they always say you rewrite the film in the editing room, but we really rewrote it. I mean, the screenplay is on the special edition DVD if you ever want to check it out, but it really got rewritten.
Interesting, because, you know, like you had mentioned something that I brought up, and I mean, not to dwell too much on negatives or anything, but I think also because the ending, you know, the climax of it is so strong and so powerful and messed up that, I think a lot of what leads up to it is very different. You know, it just feels very different. There's a different kind of pace that goes on through the middle portion of the film, and I think that's kind of what you're talking about. It's almost like it stops being a thriller for a while, you know what I mean, and then it comes, and then it kicks back in again.
Yeah, and some of that was on purpose, and would have been okay if we'd had one or two scares in there that I'd wanted to have. A lot of it was on purpose because I really wanted to, you know, I mean, I looked at this as it might be the only time I ever get to make a movie, and I'm not somebody who wants to do something that's been done. I really like to try to express something fresh. And so I really looked at, and we've talked about The Wicker Man, but a lot of the plot came from Chinatown, including the last name of the characters and some of the end plot. And the other movie that I really used to try to make a thriller fresh because I think Don't Look Now is just brilliant and so effective because it makes you care about the characters that they kill. And what I saw is really missing from thriller and horror in the aughts, and really even like half of the 90s, was caring about the characters. And so to me, that was the most successful film that's ever done that, where you're just so invested in the, I mean, because everybody, no matter what their clique is, roots for a relationship at the heart of it. Everybody wants love to work. And so when you have one of the most graphic love scenes ever, lovingly filmed between Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland, and you really feel for this character, and God, you so want them to make it. And at the end of, okay, spoiler, of like a 35-year-old movie, at the end of Don't Look Now, he gets killed. It's fucking devastating. I mean, this is not some movie that you walk away from and you're like, whoop-de-doo, that was a fun Michael Bay Friday the 13th remake. You know, you're fucking devastated, which is the way horror should be. I mean, it's really examining, like, the emotions of what we fear the most and what are taboo and you know, what scares us. And you feel it all because you fucking cared about them. And I really, really looked at that and tried to create that between Jenny and Puck as the anchoring force of the film. Because what I really feel is missing is we, you know, project so much onto our female protagonist, and they're so often told from a male point of view.
Yes.
You don't feel the horror of the woman. And what I really wanted, and what I've been told is effective for the people that the commune works for, is at the end of the film, people are devastated. They're devastated by what's happened to Jenny. They feel it themselves, which is exactly what I wanted. I wanted them to feel it through the point of view of a 16-year-old girl and to feel that vulnerable and to feel that devastated and to be like, that's fucking horrific. That is horrible. And that's what I wanted, because I feel like, you know, a lot of my plot points in the commune, you know, aren't supernatural. There's things that happen in real life every day.
Right.
There were a ton of stories that came out right after we made it of real life situations just like Jenny. And it happens every day. I mean, it happens to 1 in 5 girls. So, like, you know, to really take something that normally would be ignored or be, you know, a story that people wouldn't care about and wrap it up in an entertaining thriller horror and make people feel a romance and feel her point of view and then at the end be upset, to me, is just a huge victory. And that's, I think, why people really see it as a 70s throwback, is because there's actually emotion and character work in it.
Well, yeah, speaking about the character work, and not to belabor the point, but one thing that kind of drew me in with the movie was that the characters are strong, and especially, well, I mean, we haven't even mentioned the character of the father, Jenny's father, who is Stuart G. Bennett, right, is the actor who plays him. He's a terrific nutball in this movie, let me just say. Very
he's a fabulous actor.
Very strong,
he's a
villain.
Crazy chameleon too.
Yes. I liked him a lot, so I definitely want to get that out there. I did like him a lot, the interesting thing to me, obviously the central dynamic is the couple here, Jenny and Puck. And this is coming from, I don't know if this is a guy thing or a guy's point of view, but what I found to be interesting and what made her character seem real to me was that, honestly, she was not, she's your lead character and you feel for her, but she's also not completely likable. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, completely.
Like, there's a lot of parts in there where I was just kind of rolling my eyes at her, as not as an actress, but as a character, you know, and yet in a lazier kind of a movie or a lazier characterization, she would have just been the paper thin kind of mean girl prototype. But instead, she's actually a real person who just happens to be flawed and occasionally annoying. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I mean, that was definitely a plan. We knew that with casting Chantel, there was a lot of discussion of who to cast. And that was a really big moment was, you know, I was a little bit concerned with her skewing that way. Would there be too much gratification at the end for what happens to her? And we worked really hard to let little moments chip in on that exterior so that you gradually, you know, there's no pet the dog moment in the first 5 minutes where you like the protagonist. It's definitely more like The Wicker Man, where, you know, you get to a sense of empathy with the person and you understand them.
Yes.
But I don't know if she's ever truly, really likable.
Well, that's the thing. You go.
No, I'll be quiet.
I'm sorry. We're both blabbermouths. That's the problem here.
I know.
It's dueling blabbermouths. So my apologies to the listeners. But I think, you know, when she first shows up, for example, at the commune, you know, she's immediately bitchy to these people, even before we learn that she has a reason to be. You know what I mean? Even before we learn how depraved they actually are, she's already being unnecessarily nasty to them. You know what I mean? I mean, later on we see that it's more than deserved. But in the beginning, it's sort of like, well, why is she being such a jerk to these people?
Yeah, and Chantal and I had a lot of discussions about tone. I really feel that the biggest job a director has is you're the keeper of the tone. And that when a film goes wrong, that's what's happened. Because you're the only one that has the whole movie in your mind throughout the whole thing. And people can come up to you from different departments and have wonderful ideas that they're trying to contribute. And frankly, they'd be great if it were just that scene. Mm-hmm. But you have to keep the entire movie in line in your head and be like, nope, that's going to totally fuck us up, because in 10 days when we shoot this other scene, it's not going to match when we cut it in the editing room, because we're going to go from this happy tone to this too sad tone. And, you know, and so, you know, I really feel that's the director's biggest job. And one of the things that Chantal was most concerned about as an actress that she kept coming up to me about was, am I being too bitchy? And I was like, no, you're right in line. You're right where you're supposed to be. Keep going. You're good. And we had that conversation over and over again, and I was just like, trust me. And, you know, it worked. I think it totally works. I think it's totally believable. And it's a hard movie to talk about without giving everything away, but, you know, since this is one of the plot points that's really guessable, it's also very in line with an abused woman. You know, I mean, my character and her character are the two most typical reactions to sexual abuse. So if you go back and look at it from that point of view later, I mean, this movie is going to be taught in a university next week in a psychology course, and it's starting to make the rounds around the narcissist expert community. We've had several people that are giving us quotes from there. It's very psychologically accurate, and that's another thing that we have going for us, is that these characterizations are right, and this is how people react in real life to the things that happen.
It's not a simple and easy kind of a characterization. It would be very easy to go over the line and just make Jenny into this character that you just want to see bad things happen to, you know, but it never goes there. It never goes that far, you know? And,
The other thing I'm really proud of is, you know, some people who haven't been around 16-year-old girls do the whole, oh, she looks so old, which pisses me off so much, because, like...
All right, I won't say it then.
I don't know if you were one of the people, I wasn't slamming you if you were one of the people who says it. But I've worked with kids, you know, I'm dating a guy right now who is, you know, teaches high school. Let me tell you, that's exactly what 16-year-old girls look like, first of all. It was a plot point. Because she's been sexually abused, if you've watched any of Dr. Drew's shows, a lot of the women put on a lot of makeup. That's one of the things that a sexually abused woman does, is she can't look at her face in the mirror, and she hides from the world by putting on a lot of makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the film, Jenny actually devolves as she's having a healthy relationship with Puck. She ages less in each scene. So she starts off when she's first at the commune in the 4-inch high heels and the full-on makeup as a 16-year-old girl. And when she gets to the point where she's with him and she's ready to lose her virginity, it's the youngest she's ever looked in the film. And she actually truly looks her age and has very little makeup on and is in the, like, kind of Alice in Wonderland-looking dress. And she's wearing flat shoes for the first time. And it's something that we very consciously plan throughout the film to be true again to... what do these women actually do when this is their existence? And it's something that Kat actually warned me about it. You know, she was like, you got to dye your hair brown and let her not use any makeup. And I, because she knew that I was going to get dinged by reviewers for this. And I have. But about a third of the reviewers really get it. And they know what's going on. And I just keep going with that. I'm just going to let the other people have something bad to focus on that they can take apart and know that there are some people out there that get what I was doing and why. But it is purposeful.
Okay. I will buy that. And
okay.
No, it does make sense. I wanted to mention Puck, though, real quickly, because I think that this is kind of a funny thing to me, because this ties in to the feminine point of view of this movie, because I can't help but feel like that character is a character that will divide people. I feel like, because it's made from a female point of view, like, he's the kind of a guy in the movie where, like, I can see women kind of falling for him as a character, and every guy just wanting to just punch him in the face. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that make sense at all?
That's me, but a lot less than you think. I was actually surprised that you liked the movie and wanted to talk to me, because usually when people don't like Puck, they don't like the film. The entire film doesn't work for them. And one thing that's been very interesting to me is that I've really learned, having made this film and having shown it to so many different people, that there is no right or wrong answer. I mean, you know, we always forget that art is subjective, and that we all have our own filters and life experiences we're bringing to it. And about every character, I have literally had maybe half the people come up to me and say, oh my God, that actor is brilliant. They made the movie for me. I loved them. And then had the other half come up to me and say the opposite. Wow, the movie was so good. What a shame that you had this person in it. He was so irritating. She was so irritating. They were such a bad actor. Literally, 8 different characters. I've had people tell me about this. So I've really gotten that you can't please everybody, that everybody has a different point of view, a different world point of view. But what I find is, if Puck doesn't work for you, the whole second act isn't going to work for you. So I'm really happy and shocked that you like the film.
Well, I'll tell you why, but I'll tell you why it fits for me, even though, yeah, I'll admit that the character, yes, did rub me a bit of the wrong way with the black nail polish and the wax chest and all that kind of stuff, whatever. But I will tell you why I think it sort of fits, and the reason is because, you know, we talked about the female point of view. How many times have we seen a movie, right, 90% of other movies that are made from a male point of view, where you'll have the female equivalent of that character, where every guy thinks this is such a cool chick, and wow, how awesome is this character, and every girl just wants to kind of stick her finger down her throat. Do you know what I mean? It happens all the time, and I think this is just, if my perception, maybe other guys' perception, is it's just the opposite version of that, is you're seeing a character that might appeal more to a female viewer than a male viewer. I don't know if it's because they feel threatened. I don't know what the reason is, but I do equate it to when you see these movies where you'll have a female character that guys tend to really like and think is cool, and their girlfriends or wives will think is awful.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm not entirely sure it's gender divided. I'll have to keep gathering data on it, because there haven't that many people who don't like him, to be honest. But it has, when it's been somebody who hasn't liked him and has actually, I've heard that punched thing before, it's been a guy in the horror community.
Oh, no.
A really active guy in the horror community. So I don't know, I honestly think it might be a reaction to Twilight or something.
Ah.
I think it's maybe the Twitards are getting you. And I made this before that. So I didn't know any. I was going back to my high school days, and it's actually based on somebody real. So this wasn't, you know, for me, it wasn't the manufactured thing that I think people read into it now, because we've got almost a boy band mentality about that goth culture.
Interesting.
And so I don't know if that helps you any to think it wasn't, you know, a superficial made-up thing, you know, from my point of view of like, yay, I'm going to sell it to all these 16-year-old girls.
Oh, I think it's totally just a lack of self-esteem on my part, just watching it and just being all jealous and bitter and angry.
I support, if that helps. helps any.
What?
He's adorable, but he's kind of short.
Oh, he's short? Okay, I feel a little better now. That's good, because I'm almost...
Sorry, okay, good. Well, and there aren't, with what goes on in the movie, there aren't a lot of girls who don't walk away thinking he's a douchebag. And I'll tell you, here's another scene. Here's something else that I haven't gotten to tell anybody audio-wise. It's kind of a cool story that I've told in a few Q&As. But David Lago is an Emmy-winning actor. He's fantastic. He worked really hard with me, you know, on his character, and was very good about coming to me and saying, you know, hey, I think, you know, totally respect your writing, but I think maybe this line would work better. And we worked really well together on that. And so when the scene at the end of the movie wasn't working, their little breakup scene near the end.
Right.
He came to me several times and gave me the guy's point of view and was like, look, no guy would do this because, and then he gave me all these logical reasons that made sense. And I can't, like, talk too much about the plot because that would give it away, but there's a breakup scene. And he was like, no, this isn't what a guy would say. And I rewrote it, like, 3 or 4 times for him. And finally I was like, I'm not quite getting this. I'm inching along closer, but we're going to shoot it in 2 weeks. So fuck this. Be gentle with me. I'm giving you my real breakup scene. And I wrote out word for word a breakup that had just happened to me that month beforehand. And Chantel came over, and it was actually our first rehearsal. She'd just been cast. She was the last puzzle piece that came in. And we were about to go shoot a week later. And David and Chantel and I had red wine, and I said, be gentle and read it. And I sat across from them, and they read the breakup scene, and he had a hand on Chantel's knee, and he had a hand on mine. And it was like a little orgy. We just sat there, and we went through the breakup scene, and Chantel was crying by the end of it, and I was crying, and I looked over at him, and he was like, perfect.
Oh, wow.
And that was the only time, we ever rehearsed the breakup scene. And that was it. No, it just went into the movie. So, yeah.
Well, okay.
And the breakup scene, actually, when we filmed it, had two of the girls on set crying. And Chantel was such a mess. She was so into it. She was so fantastic. She would sit there and cry and watch the car drive away. And then after each cut, she'd run up to where I was on the hill, and I'd hug her and just sit there and hold her, and then we'd, like, do the next take. It was so well done. But, like, this whole time that we've been shooting the movie, you know, the breakup was fresh in my head, and I did not understand it from a female gender perspective. I was so, so confused. And I was really excited as a writer and a person to get to put it into the script, because I'm like, oh my God, David Lago, this Emmy-winning actor, is playing this character. He's embodying Tuck. I'm going to get my answers. As soon as we shoot this, I'm going to get my answers. So as soon as it was done, like, you know, I think that was we wrapped, because it was nighttime. I think that was the end of it. I kind of waited, you know, like as long as I could, which was about 2 minutes. I walked up to him, and, you know, I got to ask the question, which, as a girl who'd been dumped, was all I'd wanted to ask for like 3 months, which is, okay, so when you were doing that scene, what were you thinking? Like, what did it mean? What were you thinking? What does... And he looked at me and he goes, I don't fucking know, Liz. You're the one who wrote it.
There's an actor for you. See? Nice. You had your whole ulterior motive of writing this scene so you could figure out what happened in your life, and he had no answers for you.
I still don't know. That's why you should just go to therapy instead of making a movie. You'll never find your answers that way.
There you go. Well, so now, the future of the commune now, is there, what's going to happen with this movie? Are you still working on getting it out there? Other distribution outlets that you're hoping for or that could happen?
Well, we're up on IndieFlix now, where you can buy the DVD or download it. They're actually kind of a broker. They like fill in for indie films as basically the distributor now. to get us onto Netflix and Amazon and some other places that are hard to get onto if you don't have a distributor. Right. Netflix won't speak to you unless you have a distributor or with IndieFlix.
Right.
So the only problem is Netflix is actually making this whole push over into taking over Europe and switching from having physical DVDs to just doing streaming. So they're actually starting to get rid of a lot of their DVDs, which is why for some of you who have 500 movies in your Netflix queues, like I do, you'll start noticing that movies are disappearing and say they're not available. And that's why, is they've totally changed their policy. They're not really supporting indie films anymore. They're not interested in buying more. And they actually want a marketing plan for me for, like, what they're going to do with their 30 copies if they buy them, which is, like, $300 to me. So I'm kind of like, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
I don't know if I really want to write a 20-page marketing plan for $300. It's kind of pissing me off.
No, it's sort of insulting, honestly.
I know, right? I mean, like, why not just go with iTunes and Amazon? Yeah. But so right now, like, that's where we're at, is we're, you know, in application form waiting for this track. I'm in the indie world right now, but it's even weirder time just in the film business at all, because for the most part, the distributors are going business. And, you know, it's just not the same thing as going to a festival and having a decent film and getting representation and getting your film out there anymore. It's
right.
It's unfortunately all about you taking the next 2 or 3 years to do that yourself. And I'm trying to do it. And I have good days and I have bad days, and sometimes I'm just too burnt out to work on it. But, you know, a lot of the times I spend my day, you know, talking to a fan on the phone who's bought the film, or, you know, writing a personal letter to them and mailing off a DVD and, you know, really trying to connect one-on-one with the fans. And I'm hoping, you know, to just eventually be able to build up my 1,000 true fan base so that I can make it, you know, maybe make as much as I would if I was working at McDonald's, you know, making little shorts and features and stuff for those people, and just directly, you know, having contact with the people who like what I'm doing and getting feedback from them and continuing on and making entertainment for them. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny that I live in LA, because I don't really need to. I mean, there's kind of no purpose anymore to being here. You definitely, I think in the next 4 or 5 years, we'll see a huge, huge change that's visible, even to people who aren't here, as far as film festivals don't matter anymore and everybody's just going directly to the web.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I mean, things are changing so quickly now. And you've actually done, I think, a fine job of connecting to people. And obviously, and this interview is an example of, you know, your accessibility and things like that in making this work. And I think, you know, what happens now with the internet it's a blessing and a curse kind of a thing, because, you know, there are ways for people, legal ways, hopefully, for people to experience films now and have access to them that they might not have had in the past. You know, I can remember living in New York. A lot of people have heard of the Angelica Film Center, which is sort of like the mother of all, you know, art house theaters in Greenwich Village in Manhattan. And I remember, you know, back in college, we would have to sort of trek down there to see any kind of cool indie movie we wanted to see, you know, and people don't really have to do that anymore, you know. And like I said, it's a blessing and a curse. And there's lots of ways now that people can find your film, which I guess is a good thing. And, you know, I'll be attaching to this post all of the contact information for the website and things like that for people who are curious to check the film out, so that they can do that. But I want to thank you for agreeing to come on and talk so in depth about this film and giving me so much of your time.
Oh my God, are you kidding me? Thank you for providing the opportunity. I mean, it's that you provide the forum and the interest and you know, hopefully some like-minded fans that I can connect with is just, I mean, I can't even tell you what it means to me. It's just provides a huge need for me that I thank you for. I mean, you're definitely a hero. It's wonderful. I appreciate it. And you know what? This is what I love. I mean, I could do this all day long. I could talk to you for another 8 hours. I just, you know, storytelling and filmmaking is what I love, and you know, it's a privilege for me anytime I have some time to talk to somebody who loves it too. So, thank you.
Well, that's good. No, it's my pleasure, and I'm happy to do it. And it's kind of funny that this interview has actually lasted almost exactly as long as the film itself. So I don't quite know what that means, but it's sort of interesting. But again, Elizabeth Fees, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking to the commune. I hope everybody out there enjoyed it and will check out this film. Thank you.
Thank you.